Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 18, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the teleforum conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing today's two U.S. Supreme Court decisions on free speech. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And in the interest of full disclosure, just to let you know that our guest today, Professor Eugene Volokh, is affiliated with the First Amendment Clinic at his law school, and that clinic filed an amicus brief at the cert grant stage in the Reed versus Town of Gilbert case, and at the merits stage, on the side of what became ultimately the view of the dissenting justices in the Walker versus Texas Division Sons of Confederate Veterans case. Our guest today, return guest, we're very happy to have him back, Professor Eugene Volokh. He's the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA Law School. He's going to give us background and then analysis of each case in turn for about 10 to 12 minutes each. But then, as always, we'll be turning to you for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. Professor Volokh, the floor is yours.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me do this. I always very much enjoy these kinds of calls. So today we saw two really significant First Amendment cases, or at least potentially significant, as we will see. One of them might be narrow, might be broad. Time alone will tell, as is true with so much. So the first case that I'll talk about is the Reed v. Town of Gilbert case. This involves a sign ordinance. Now, many cities have ordinances and some states have statutes that limit signs, limit the size of signs, the location of signs, and the theory behind those laws, and incidentally there's also a federal statute along these lines as well, is that signs cause visual clutter. They're aesthetically unappealing. They interfere with the enjoyment of the scenery, and they're also distracting to drivers. In fact, signs only work if they attract the driver's attention, and when the driver's attention is on the sign, it's not on the road in front of him. Now, some of these ordinances are limited to commercial signs, and it's probably the case that restriction on commercial advertising, because of the commercial speech doctrine, would be generally permissible in this kind of context. There are some interesting twists with that. Let's set that aside, and let's focus on restrictions on signs that are not commercial, that are political, religious, and the like. Some places restrict these signs in a way that is genuinely content neutral. So they may say, look, you can't have signs larger than this size, no matter what is on the sign. And that would usually be constitutional as a permissible content neutral time, place, and manner regulation. But quite a few places have restrictions that have certain kinds of exceptions. For example, for historical landmark signs, or just generally categorized signs based on their subject matter, presumably in the theory that some signs are especially valuable, and therefore there ought to be more latitude for them. The town of Gilbert in Arizona, in particular, split up non-commercial signs into three categories. There were political signs, basically campaign-oriented signs, which could be quite large, but had to be taken down not long after the election. There were other ideological signs which expressed other viewpoints on other issues, which could be large but couldn't be as large as the political signs. Those, however, could be up indefinitely. And then there were temporary event signs. If you wanted to put on some event, you could put up a sign, but you had to put it up 12 hours before the event, take it down at 1 hour after the event, and the sign itself could only be much, much smaller than the other signs. The city said, look, we're not actually trying to suppress any bad ideas. We're not engaged in viewpoint discrimination here. We're not hostile to events or to ideology. We just want to provide a bit more latitude for, say, political campaign signs or for ideological signs than for other signs. Then the Ninth Circuit, by a 2-1 vote, upheld that, concluding that because the city had or at least lacked a bad motivation, lacked any desire to suppress speech, the ordinance should be viewed as content neutral and therefore constitutional. And that's what the Supreme Court agreed to consider in Reed v. Town of Gilbert. Whether these kinds of ordinances and when these kinds of ordinances should be treated as content neutral, even when on their face they drew distinctions based on content. The Supreme Court has long said that content-based restrictions, with a few exceptions, are presumptively unconstitutional. The question is, what counts as a content-based restriction? And in this case, by a 9-0 vote, the court struck down this restriction. And the justices all agreed it should be viewed as content-based. But there was a substantial disagreement between six justices who signed on to the majority opinion and then three justices who concurred only in the judgment. The six justices in the majority, which was written by Justice Thomas, were basically the conservatives, joined by Justice Sotomayor. Interestingly, the same makeup as in the Sorrell v. IMS Health case, which also involved a content discrimination question, involved a speech about doctors' pharmaceutical prescription practices. But in any event, somewhat unusual lineup. But the majority position was, look, if a restriction is facially content-based, if the government distinguishes based on speech, distinguishes among speech based on what it communicates, then that is presumptively unconstitutional. That's subject to strict scrutiny, again, setting aside the usual exceptions for libel and obscenity and the like. And that is that. If the restriction is facially content-based, we don't look to whether the government has a benign motive and then reclassify the restriction as content-neutral instead. Once it's facially content-based, it is content-based. Now, if the restriction is facially content-neutral, it might still be found to be content-based if it turns out that the government adopted the law because of disagreement with the message that the speech conveyed. But for a facially content-based law, that's the end of the story, at least as far as the inquiry into whether the law is content-based or not goes. And that made this a very easy case. This restriction was content-based. It failed strict scrutiny. That's that. Interestingly, there was a concurrence by three of the justices who joined in the majority. It was a concurrence just to express their separate views, and part of this concurrence simply said, look, we just want to make clear that certain kinds of content-neutral restrictions are just fine. For example, restrictions on size, location, lighting, changing messages on electronic signs, and the like. So they wanted to stress that cities shouldn't say, oh, now we can't regulate signs at all. Sure, you can regulate them, the concurrence said, just you have to regulate them in a content-neutral way. But then the concurrence gave two other examples, which actually seemed to be content-based under the majority's test, which, recall, those concurring justices actually claimed to endorse. By the way, the concurrence was by Justice Alito, joined by Kennedy and Sotomayor. The examples they gave are rules distinguishing between on-premises and off-premises signs. That's a pretty common kind of sign restriction, which says, for example, that if a business wants to advertise itself, it's free to do that, but if it wants to promote other things, essentially to sell space on its sign to other businesses or ideological entities, then that's not permitted. So those restrictions are common, but they're pretty clearly content-based under the majority's view. They distinguish signs based on what is on the sign, whether what is on the sign is related to the business or not. Yet the concurring justices said, well, that's content-neutral. Another example they gave is rules imposing time restrictions on signs advertising a one-time event. Well, again, that's viewpoint neutral, but it is content-based under the majority view. So this suggests that the majority opinion sort of gives, and then the concurrence from three of the justices who signed on to the majority opinion and whose votes were necessary to make a majority now takes away. So the majority opinion is broadly restrictive of content-based restrictions, that is to say, which says, generally speaking, content-based restrictions are unconstitutional. But maybe it's not quite that broad if lower courts end up following the concurrence rather than the majority. I'll only briefly talk about the concurrences in judgment just because they lost, and I want to focus more on the practical implications of this case. Justice Kagan, joined by Justice Breyer and Ginsburg, basically said, look, this hostility to content-based restrictions is often wise, but is actually somewhat overstated. Maybe we are condemning content-based restrictions too sharply. Maybe there should be more room for certain kinds of content-based restrictions that look like they're not really likely to interfere with public debate much at all. And one example she gave is one that we mentioned earlier, which has to do with signs indicating some historical landmarks and such. What's so bad about saying, look, you can't generally have large signs except for signs indicating historical landmarks? Where's the harm to public debate in that? But the majority's view was, look, the majority didn't specifically talk about historical landmarks, but the implications of the majority position is that, hey, that's content-based, that's unconstitutional, end of story. So that's part of what the debate was about. Now, there are two important possible implications for the future that are worth mentioning, in addition to this uncertainty about the full scope of the majority opinion that I mentioned a little earlier. One has to do with the so-called erogenous zoning cases. The cases in which the court upheld zoning restrictions on pornographic bookstores and movie theaters. In those cases, and in some other cases, the court articulated what is called the secondary effects doctrine, the theory that even a facially content-based law could be constitutional if it doesn't really target the primary effects of the speech, its persuasiveness or its offensiveness or the harms that flow from that, but secondary effects, like, for example, the possible diminished property values that come when an adult bookstore opens up in a neighborhood, or possibly extra crime from people attracted to the neighborhood as a result. Well, those laws are exactly what the court seems to be condemning in its majority opinion. Those decisions. Their decisions that, like the Ninth Circuit decision below, said, hey, here's a facially content-based law, but we're going to treat it as content-neutral because it has a good motivation behind it. In fact, if anything, the motivation behind the law was a lot more suspect in those cases, even though the court concluded that the motivation wasn't really hostile to the underlying speech. Now, on the one hand, those were cases, there's a pretty substantial line of those secondary effects cases, and Justices Scalia and Thomas, who joined the majority in this case, supported those cases, often voted in the majority in those cases. And there's nothing in the court's opinion that mentions those cases, so I don't think it's trying to overrule those cases. At the same time, those cases are very hard to reconcile with this hard line, if it's facially content-based, then it's content-based, position that the majority took. The one other thing I want to mention about this is a case that might be on the minds of some of you already, which is Hill v. Colorado. Recall that back in 2000, the Supreme Court upheld as content-neutral a state law that barred people from approaching within 8 feet of patrons of healthcare facilities, hospitals, or most often abortion clinics, for purposes of education or counseling or oral protest. And the majority in that case said, well, that's really a content-neutral law because it's counseling, education, oral protest on any kind of issue, although practically it would almost always be abortion. And Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy sharply dissented, said, this is ridiculous. This is clearly a content-based law. When a law focuses on oral protest education or counseling, it's focusing on speech of a particular kind of content. Even if it were viewpoint neutral, which they were skeptical about, the law is content-based. Well, how is that consistent with a majority opinion here? It turns out the majority opinion, when it cites Hill, it only cites the dissents and approvingly cites the dissents in Hill. So I think it's pretty likely that the Colorado law will be challenged again. And while Hill is not expressly overruled in this case, I think lower courts may well uphold the Colorado law, but then I think there'll be another challenge brought before the Supreme Court saying, look, the Reed decision casts doubt, in fact, should be seen as invalidating the Colorado law and overruling Hill. So potentially an important case with a lot of implications. How broad the implications are is not completely clear. But a pretty firm reaffirmation by the majority of the principle that content discrimination is generally unconstitutional. And the first question in any content discrimination issue is, what does the law say on its face? It's not the motivation of the legislature. If the law is facially content-based, then it should be treated as content-based. So that's Reed v. Town of Gilbert. Now, on to, Walker v. Sons of Confederate Veterans. Texas decided to raise money by having a specialty license plate program, specialty license plate design program. So pretty much any group can say, we want a particular design that our members and supporters could then buy, and we'll basically pay about $8,000 up front to the state as an advance on whatever income it might get from people who actually buy those plates. So it's a fundraising measure for the state of Texas, and for organizations, it's a way of spreading their ideas, and for drivers, it's a way of saying, hey, I support this group. Well, along comes the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and they want to have a license plate of their own, which includes the Confederate battle flag. No, 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 says Texas. We don't want that. That's too likely to be offensive. Interestingly, Texas allowed a Choose Life license plate. It allowed a Trophy Hunters Association license plate, other kinds of controversial plates, but not Sons of Confederate Veterans. The question in this case was whether this license plate program is a sort of non-public forum or limited public forum, in either of which viewpoint discrimination is forbidden, or whether this program should be treated as government speech, like, for example, monuments that the government puts up or allows to be put up in a park, which is a program where the government can discriminate based on viewpoint. The government can say, we'll take a monument honoring Martin Luther King Jr., but we won't take a monument honoring Bull Connor, let's say. Likewise, the state was saying, we can say we'll take a particular license plate design that expresses a viewpoint that we favor, or at least don't oppose, but will reject reject license plate designs that we disapprove of, because after all, it's our license plate issued by the state of Texas and is therefore government speech. And the Supreme Court held by a 5-4 vote that this is indeed something that should be treated as government speech. That's something that relates to this the monument issue that I mentioned. There was a case called Pleasant Grove versus Summum several years ago in which the court upheld a city's decision to allow certain monuments and not other monuments, and pointed to three major factors, which both the majority and the dissent talk about. One is whether this is a medium that historically has been used by the government to speak to the public. So monuments, the court has said, monuments and parks are generally a way for the government to honor particular people or causes or ideas. Likewise, the majority said, license plates historically have been used to disseminate state-created slogans. It's only recently, in the last few decades, that states have opened them up to private organizations as a revenue-raising measure. On the other hand, the dissent says, well, no, no, no. The right history to look at isn't the history of all license plates, but rather precisely the history of specialty license plates. And once you look at that, you see that, in fact, they have indeed been open to the public to speak rather than open for the government to speak. A sec- second factor that the majority pointed to is whether materials are closely identified in the public mind with the state. And the court says, look, this is a license plate that says Texas. It's issued by Texas. Everybody knows it's issued by the state government. People are going to associate it with the state and view it as having the imprimatur of the state. And the dissent said, ha, that makes no sense at all. This is Justice Alito writing. The example he gave is you sit by the highway and you look at the license plates. And there come various license plates. One says, rather be golfing. That's one design that's out there. Do you think, ooh, that's the official policy of the state, better to be golfing than working? Or there's another one that has a University of Texas license plate. Well, you might say, well, that is the state policy. But there's another one that has a Oklahoma State license plate or a Notre Dame license plate. Well, do you think, oh, the Texas also endorses Notre Dame? You don't. The dissent said you wouldn't actually reasonable people wouldn't actually view these kinds of license plates as closely identified with the state. Then the third summum factor was whether the government maintains control over the selection of the speech. And the majority says, well, yes, it does. In fact, the government has rejected a few such plates and still reserves ultimate control. And the dissent said, well, in fact, this is a program in which overwhelming majority, nearly all of the many dozens of applications are approved, and therefore, really, this isn't the kind of selectivity that, say, with a National Endowment for the Arts or some other genuinely selective programs may authorize a finding that this is the government actually speaking. So what's happening here is that there are these factors for determining what's government speech and what's not. They're pretty mushy factors. The majority in the dissent takes a very different view about how to apply them, and it's not like this case really clarifies how to apply them in the future. Now, so that's basically the shape of the opinions here. But let's look to the future. What are the implications of this case? So the first thing that we have to recognize is, on its own terms, the case is a case about next to nothing. For the simple reason that now that the Sons of Confederate Veterans can't have this license plate, what can they do? They can get a bumper sticker. They can get a bumper sticker, attach it to their car, anybody who supports the Sons of Confederate Veterans. It will be cheaper than a specialty license plate. It will be could be larger, could be more visible, could be more flexible, and there are many more designs and more detailed designs that could be used. Really, as a practical matter, this decision doesn't have much of an effect on public debate at all, and I think that has to be acknowledged whether you like the majority opinion or not. But the real question is, what do you do about the many other kinds of government-private speech partnerships, in a sense, which do matter a lot more? Let's take an example. The charitable tax exemption and the deductibility of charitable tax contributions. Should that be treated as a kind of a limited public forum in which the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint, which is the current understanding? Or could it be seen as a form of government speech, whereby giving somebody tax-exempt status, the government is putting its imprimatur on that speaker and therefore should be able to say, nope, we're not going to give tax-exempt status to allegedly racist groups or anti-gay groups or whatever else. What about student loans? Could there be viewpoint-based conditions attached to them? And here's the one other example, which turns out, I think, to be very practically relevant because it's being litigated right now. What about trademarks? There's, of course, a hot dispute right now with the Redskins as to whether the federal government, whether the Patent Trademark Office, should cancel, as in fact the lower court has held to be the case, should cancel the Redskins mark on the grounds that it's disparaging to American Indians. Now, there's a controversy as to whether it is or isn't, but the federal statute does specifically say that marks that disparage a person or a group are not registrable. And that's been used to deny registration to Redskins. It's been used to deny registration to, for example, the mark Stop the Islamization of America, on the grounds that that mark was disparaging towards towards Muslims. Also was used to deny registration to a group, an Asian American rock group called The Slants, on the grounds that The Slants is a pejorative term for Asians, even though, of course, this is an Asian group who's trying to kind of reclaim the term for themselves. Well, if you look at the trademark laws, you might view the trademark, registered trademark status, as a kind of government-provided benefit to a particular group of speakers. And then the question is, do we treat this as a non-public forum or limited public forum in which viewpoint discrimination is forbidden, including discrimination against allegedly bigoted viewpoints, or do we view this as a form of government speech on the grounds that the government is putting its imprimatur on trademarks, the government is putting them on the government-run principal trademark register, the government is allowing you to attach the little TM symbol or the little R with a circle symbol that was created by the government to those marks, in which case the government could discriminate based on viewpoint. Sounds familiar? That's the very issue that was involved in Sons of Confederate Veterans, but here one in which a lot is at stake. In Sons of Confederate Veterans, practically very little was at stake, because if you can't put it on a license plate, you can put it on a bumper sticker. In the trademark context, potentially a lot is at stake, because there's no really quite as good substitute for having a registered trademark. This issue, in fact, the Slants case, which has the name In Re Tam, is now pending before the Federal Circuit. So if you want to see the first case in which Sons of Confederate Veterans is going to be argued about, at least in a practically important way outside the license plate context, it turns out I'm pretty certain it's going to be the trademark context. Sounds very different. Trademarks, license plate, designs, we generally don't think of them together, but structurally the issue is really quite similar. It'll be interesting to see how it'll come out. I think that the Slants, the group the Slants, should win, and I think the Redskins should win as well. I think that should happen even after Sons of Confederate Veterans. I think the trademarks are basically not seen by the public as a form of government speech. They're not directly associated with the state's name on a state-provided license plate. But it is pretty clear that this case is going to be argued about in the Federal Circuit litigation, and that in some measure this case does kind of help the government in situations where it wants to support its viewpoint-based partnership programs on the grounds that this is government speech and the government can pick and choose what to endorse. So, quick run through two very complicated cases. I'm happy to answer questions and give more details as to these things in the questions and answers.
Well, let's open the floor to questions. Thank you, Professor. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who rings in. Tomorrow, our next scheduled teleform conference call will be at 12 noon Eastern Time on securities markets and market regulation. Next week, we will undoubtedly have some Courthouse Steps teleform conference calls, depending on what the Supreme Court does on Monday, its next scheduled decision day. And just a quick other announcement, we hosted our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference today. It was live streamed, but it was also recorded, of course, and those recordings are now available on the Federalist Society's YouTube page. Today, of course, we're talking about a couple decisions, free speech decisions, with Professor Eugene Volokh. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question for the professor. Let's now go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, sorry. This is my name is Christopher Jackson. Just a question about the Sons of the Confederate case. Does this case now call into question some of the lower court decisions, and I'm thinking particularly here of the Fourth Circuit, in which the courts have held that if a state offers a license plate that has one particular political viewpoint, such as a pro-life message, that the state must also offer a pro-choice message, and if it does not do so, then it's constitutionally forbidden from offering only one side of the debate. Does this case now call those precedents into question?
Yeah, I think it does. The whole premise of those precedents was that, look, you're opening up a program for private speech. It's essentially a kind of limited public forum, or at least a non-public forum. You can't discriminate based on a viewpoint. You can't discriminate in favor of anti-abortion viewpoints, let's say, and against pro-abortion rights viewpoints. That's the very position that the majority on the court rejected. Because that's the very position that the Sons of Confederate Veterans argued, and the Fifth Circuit accepted when the Sons of Confederate Veterans argued. Here, the Supreme Court said, look, the government can pick and choose which viewpoints it's going to endorse and say we don't want to endorse pro-Confederate veterans' viewpoints or the viewpoints that are represented by the Confederate battle flag. Well, if that's so, then the government can also choose not to endorse pro-abortion rights viewpoints.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Well, my name is John Fraser. I'm from Texas. And just a point of clarification about the license plates program. Frequently, these community groups, they enter into an agreement to share some of the proceeds that the government collects with licensing fees as a sort of fundraiser. And I'm just wondering, does that have any influence on the legal reasoning in cases like this?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I thought I'd mention that, but maybe I didn't make it clear. It's a fundraiser for the government, but at the same time, it's a fundraiser often for the groups as well. So
right.
The reason the groups put it together is that they get a chunk of the money that people pay for the license plates, and the state gets a chunk of the money. Yeah, that's right. But I think the fact that the groups get a chunk of the money doesn't change the analysis. Interestingly, Justice Alito, in his dissent, stressed that the state was getting some of the money. This was essentially a for-pay program because he said, look, if the state really wanted to express its views, why would it wait until someone pays it money to do that? And the very fact that the state says, hey, pay your money to get these license plates, suggests that the state recognizes that this is other people's views, that it's going to end up promoting there. But the majority did not take that view.
Okay. Thank you.
Professor, this is Dean asking a question, if you don't mind. You mentioned the limited scope, I suppose, of the Walker case, Sons of Confederate Veterans, and that they could now go out and buy a bumper sticker, and maybe to the same effect. But my guess is that they specifically want, not they, just them and other groups, are specifically looking for the license plate, almost because it has some measure of officialness, or maybe it's the permanence, maybe it is the imprimatur of the state and the association with the state. Is it really the same as a license plate, or are you saying it's on a par with bumper stickers, rather?
This is actually an argument that Justice Breyer made for the majority. He said, by the way, the majority were the four liberal justices and Justice Thomas. He says, look, why would they want, why would people want this specialty license plate if not for the imprimatur that it gives? I think Alito probably had the somewhat better of the argument. I think most people, when they look at rather be golfing, they don't think, ooh, Texas really supports preference for golfing over working, or especially when they see a Louisiana State University specialty license plate, say, "Ooh, here we thought Texas was rivals with the LSU, but no, they actually put their imprimatur on LSU." I doubt most people view it this way. Maybe some people kind of get a little bit kind of a little bit of jollies from saying, aha, we managed to get the state, we managed to push the state into putting up this license plate that we suspect many in the state wouldn't like, maybe. But I think there's very, very little imprimatur actually being given here. I think the reason some of these groups put together these license plates is that they do end up making some money from it. And as I understand it, people who are on the lookout for the license plates can, that is, say, drivers who are maybe interested in getting a specialty plate, see this list of them and say, oh, well, here's the Sons of Confederate Veterans one. I'll do it. In a sense, it's a little easier, though more expensive, for the drivers to include such a license plate. The last thing also is that it may be more aesthetically pleasing for some. My sense, there's some people who find bumper stickers to be kind of ugly, but wouldn't take the same view about the specialty plate program. So there are some reasons why the specialty plate program is a benefit to some of these groups. It's just a very modest benefit, given the availability of, at least modest speech benefit, maybe a substantial fundraising benefit, but a modest speech benefit given the availability of bumper stickers. And I do think that despite the majority's endorsement of this endorsement theory, despite the majority's conclusion that, well, there is an imprimatur by when this is actually printed on the license plate, I just doubt that most people, seeing the vast range of license plates that are available, would take that view.
You mentioned the lineup in the majority of Justice Thomas, joined by Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Did that surprise you, or is there anything in Justice Thomas's previous jurisprudence that telegraphed that he might end up with them on this case?
You know, it's hard to say. Every so often, these kinds of lineups do happen. For example, there was a Justice Thomas plus the liberals versus the conservatives, the rest of the conservatives lineup quite a while ago now, in Bajikagian, which was an excessive fines clause case. One possibility is this may be Justice Thomas the Federalist, in the sense of the supporter of states' rights, that is speaking here. This is an issue in which the state of Texas says, look, we should have the discretion to include in what is we believe is our speech what we want and not include what we don't want. And in fact, the majority towards the end seems to suggest that they almost have a First Amendment right to do that. They talk about the other famous license plate case, Woolley v. Maynard, and they say, well, of course, in Woolley v. Maynard, we held that a citizen should be free to tape over a slogan on the license plate he disapproves of, because after all, he shouldn't be compelled to display speech he doesn't want to display. Likewise, the state of Texas shouldn't be compelled to display speech that it doesn't want to display. Maybe it's that. But it's hard to tell. He didn't write a separate concurrence.
We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Take another call now.
I was also going to ask a question about the lineups, and it seems like in both cases, the liberal justices were voting for the position that was more restrictive of speech, with the exception of Sotomayor joining the majority in Reed. And if that surprises you at all or indicates anything about sort of trends in the liberal versus conservative jurisprudence on free speech. And then another point about the lineup, I assume some may speculate that Justice Thomas might have been particularly exercised about the Confederate veterans because of race overtones. And if you think that is an illegitimate speculation, and didn't he vote similarly in a case involving cross-burning, or am I misremembering that?
You know, I'm sure some will speculate that. I don't think I find it hard to call speculation illegitimate, but it doesn't strike me as persuasive here. Among other things, this case happened to involve the Confederate veterans, but it's pretty clear that it applied to much more speech than that. This means now the state of Texas can reject anything In fact, there was a prominent decision recently from the Second Circuit in which New York State rejected choose life license plate, so essentially an anti-abortion license plate. And it's quite clear that today, that after Sons of Confederate Veterans, the state of New York would be even more clearly able to reject such license plates. And, you know, Justice Thomas is a smart man. He's been a justice for a very long time. He's perfectly aware that this decision is going to end up having far broader effects than just on Confederate flag. I can't imagine that he would be particularly just so exercised about the Confederate flag here, a flag I suspect he doesn't have much affection for, as I don't, that would color his judgment. One other factor is if you look at a case which was a much more clearly racial offense or racial, possibly even racial threat-based case, which is the RAVV City of St. Paul case, which also involved cross-burning. Actually, I shouldn't say threats. That was litigated as a racial fighting words case. Justice Thomas was in the majority, in fact, provided the necessary fifth vote for the majority for the proposition that the ordinance there, which specifically banned bigoted, including racist fighting words, was unconstitutional. So I'm pretty sure that Justice Thomas recognizes the broader impact of this decision. Again, I can't tell you exactly why he would reach the result that he did, but I suspect he's more moved by federalism concerns than by the fortuity that this particular case happened to involve the Confederate flag. Now, on to the first part of your question about the liberal justices voting in a more speech-restrictive way. Well, I think that's right, and I think that's also true in the one of the other cases this term, which was free speech cases this term, which was the Williams-Yulee case involving judicial campaign speech, where the liberal justices, plus in that case Chief Justice Roberts, voted to uphold the restriction on judicial campaign speech, and the dissenting justices would have voted to strike that down. I do think that, and I wrote an article about this at this point now some 15 years ago, that this traditional understanding from the 60s and 70s and maybe early 80s that liberal justices support broad free speech and conservative justices support a narrower view of free speech, that just hasn't been so since at least the 1990s. Now, to be sure, there are some issues in which liberal justices do support broader free speech rights than conservative justices. Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project is actually an example of such a case involving a speech that was at least potentially violated the support of foreign terrorist organizations statute. Other examples include government employee speech, where liberal justices tend to take a broader view. Some other kinds of government-subsidized speech as well, as in the USAID v. Alliance for Open Society International case a couple of years ago, and other situations where conservative justices take a broader view of free speech rights. So I think what we have here is kind of a mix, that knowing that something is a free speech case doesn't tell you whether liberals or conservatives are more likely to support the claim, although knowing the particular details of the claim might give you a better sense.
We've still got three questions pending now, so let's carry on.
I have three answers, or maybe more.
Perfect.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Mark from Washington, D.C. If Alito's opinion in the license plate case had been the majority opinion, was there any limiting principle, or would we have Nazis and the KKK able to get their specialty plates? And then second, You mentioned Open Society versus USAID, and it seems to me like the license plate case, which was decided under the rubric of Summum, the monuments case, could have fit more neatly in the Open Society versus USAID case, which holds that the government can have set whatever program it wants and set whatever terms and conditions to participate in that program, so long as it doesn't restrict the person from speaking however they wish to on their own time and dime. And so I'm just sort of curious about the relationship between this pure government speech case and open society, which I can't quite understand.
Sure. excuse me. So let me start with your first question. No, under Alito's view, if somebody wanted to have a support the KKK or support Al-Qaeda license plate, they would have been able to have one, just like if somebody wants to have a pro-KKK advocacy group and they want to have a tax exemption for that, they'll get the tax exemption. Just like if somebody wants to copyright a racist tract, they get the benefits of copyright law, just as people who express other views do. I think if Alito were buttonholed on that, he'd say, well, yeah, that's part of the price of free speech, is that we have to tolerate views that we don't like, including in situations where there's some modest government benefit provided in an even-handed way to everybody, or even a substantial government benefit provided to everybody, including this particular group. And again, the tax exemption, charitable tax exemption, is a much, much more valuable benefit, and we give it to all sorts of groups whose views the government disapproves of. And I suppose Alito would also say that if the state of Texas were so upset by that, it could always just close the specialty license plate program and forgo whatever revenues, significant but not vast in the grand scheme of things, it gets from this program. Now, as to USAID, let me just mention, try to summarize briefly what is a complicated case there. In USAID, the government was offering funds for fighting, among other things, HIV and AIDS. But it said, if you want to get these funds, and this was funds generally overseas, if you want to get these funds as an organization, you have to have an organizational statement condemning prostitution. There's some groups that said, we don't want to have such a statement. It's not like we're big fans of prostitution, but people we often work with in preventing HIV and AIDS are prostitutes. In fact, those are the ones we most need to work with. And we don't want to be in a position where we have made this public statement condemning them, which we don't want to do because we neither endorse nor condemn prostitution. We just try to help people as best we can. And the Supreme Court, by a 6-2 vote, with Justices Scalia and Thomas dissenting, the Supreme Court said this program is unconstitutional because it attaches this condition to these government funds, and a condition that influences not just the use of the funds, but influences things you say outside the program, things you say with your own funds, indeed on your own time and dime. That turns out to be an important distinction. It's quite clear the government could say, look, we're giving you this money, but only to fight HIV. In fact, maybe we're going to give you this money for abstinence education. Not that the government does, but it could. And if we're giving you this money for abstinence education, you can't then turn around and use it for safe sex education. And if we give you the money for safe sex education, you can't then turn around and use it for teaching people that, you know, you should just have more sex without condoms and, you know, the pleasure is worth it. There, the government was clearly speaking. There was no doubt that the government was using this program to try to speak, albeit through private groups. It was just trying to control not just what they said using the funds, but even what they said using their own funds. And a line of cases dating back to 1983 and the FCC v. League of Women Voters case condemned this kind of attempt to leverage government funds into control over privately funded speech. This case was different. Here, the government really was trying to restrict speech just using its benefit. It didn't say, hey, we'll deny these designs to any group that in its own private speech, its own non-government-funded speech, supports the Confederacy. You don't get this pro-duck-hunting license plate because we think you're actually Confederate sympathizers. The government doesn't say that here. In this case, all the government says is, look, if we're going to provide you this license plate, we're going to have to pick and choose what goes on this license plate that we provide you. That's the reason this is a different case from USAID, and I think that's the reason why liberal justices such as Breyer and Ginsburg, who joined the USAID majority, saw this case as consistent, or saw their join of the majority in this case as consistent. Hello?
Yeah, we're moving to the next question. Go ahead, caller.
This is Matt from Pacific Justice Institute. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Professor. I have a couple of questions. First of all, in an otherwise terrific opinion in the Reed case, I found it a little disturbing that the court was willing to assume arguendo that aesthetics were a compelling interest. And it seems like this follows a trend where the court in recent years has been willing to assume all kinds of things are compelling interests and just skip over that to get to narrow tailoring. I'm wondering if that is a concern of yours or if you think I'm reading too much into that.
Well, what the court said after it said this is clearly content-based, when it dealt with this argument, even if it's content-based, it passes strict scrutiny, the court said, look, we don't even have to decide whether the interests here in traffic safety and in aesthetics are compelling because obviously this law is just not really at all meaningfully related to those interests. I'm not terribly worried about that. I agree that while traffic safety, you could argue, may be a compelling interest, there are lives at stake. I agree that aesthetics shouldn't be viewed as a compelling interest. But there's nothing odd, I think, about the court saying, look, we don't even have to reach this issue because the other prong of the test, the narrow tailoring prong, is so clearly not satisfied. In fact, it's the norm for courts to often say we're only going to focus on the issue that is sort of open and shut obvious. And that's especially so since the matter isn't open and shut obvious as to traffic safety. And it makes sense that the court would want to, just in a short section, analyze both of the interests the same way, both traffic safety and aesthetics. And the court does say, assuming for the sake of argument, it's pretty clear that they're not trying to pass judgment on that. I do think it would be nice if at some point the court said, look, aesthetics, not a compelling interest, maybe an important enough interest to justify content-neutral restrictions. Court has already pretty much said that, but not a compelling interest. I'm not terribly troubled that the court chose not to do that in this case.
If I could ask a further question in relation to the concurrences in Reed, it surprised me to read the degree to which it seemed like Justices Breyer and Kagan disputed the whole framework of content-based analysis. So I'm curious if that's something they've been saying for a long time and I've just missed it, or if this is a new and more extensive exposition on that.
Well, it's not new for Breyer. Pretty much ever since since he was appointed to the court, he has both taken a relatively pro-government view in free speech cases, not all of them by any means, but in the aggregate, and has specifically questioned sharp rules like the content-based, content-neutral distinction, and in particular the content-based, content-neutral distinction itself. When I wrote this opinion, the article in 2000, analyzing at that point was 6 years of where the court hadn't changed personnel, 6 years since Justice Breyer was appointed. It turned out that Justices Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, and Justice Breyer had the narrowest views in the aggregate of free speech of any of the justices. And even though, of course, Chief Justice Rehnquist is generally very conservative and Breyer was a moderate liberal. So I'm not at all surprised about Breyer on this score. I am surprised by Kagan and Ginsburg in particular. Ginsburg generally has had a relatively broad view of free speech. And, I mean, I shouldn't say it wasn't wasn't perhaps the broadest, but was certainly broader than Breyer's. Kagan was something of an unknown quantity, but there were times at least when she did express, I think, quite persuasively in many ways, a pro-free speech view. She did write a law review article back when she was a professor in which she said that the content discrimination inquiry, while an important inquiry, was really just a proxy for looking into the motives of the legislature. So maybe it shouldn't be surprising that in a case like this one, where the majority said, we don't care about the motives, all we care about is content discrimination, she would be more open to a motive-based inquiry. So I am a little bit surprised by Ginsburg's position. Not much surprised by Justice Breyer's position, which he had signaled before in past cases. And somewhat surprised, and maybe in kind of, it's maybe augurs ill for future cases, given that it's one of the few data points we have about Justice Kagan, about Justice Kagan's position. I will say there was one other justice who used to take a very similar view, and that was Justice Stevens. He, both when he was kind of seen as sort of in the conservative wing of the court back in the 70s and early 80s, and then in the liberal wing of the court in the latter part of his career, he too sharply questioned the content discrimination test. I will say, by the way, some of the condemnation or some of the questioning of the content discrimination test, I think is powerful. I think there are plausible arguments that sometimes the content-based, content-neutral distinction doesn't really capture what we think is important about free speech principles. The problem, and this is particularly clear if you look at Justice Breyer's separate opinion here and his past opinions, is what do you use instead? And what is often offered, especially by Justice Breyer, is, well, we have to consider in a sensitive and insightful way this wide range of factors. And so, and this was, of course, Justice Stevens' view, too. It's a standards-based view rather than a rules-based view. I don't think it ultimately provides that much protection for speech, especially given that the decisions the court announces are going to be applied in the first instance by an army of lower court judges, and before that, by government officials, that the more you try to have a theoretically perfect test that doesn't have kind of weird anomalies that come from the under-inclusiveness and over-inclusiveness of sharp rules, the more you try to instead come up with kind of a multi-factor, all things considered balancing test, the more unpredictable you make things for speakers, for executive officials, and for judges. And I think on balance, the less protection you have both for free speech and for legitimate government interests.
Let's take a final question now.
Professor, it's David Emerson in Berkeley. Thanks for your comments. I've got a couple of quick questions. One is that do you see that there's going to be any blowback from the specialty case decision into other areas? For example, I'm particularly thinking of cases which in the past have held that community bulletin boards on government property are still considered a public forum, and certainly in Berkeley they're a free-for-all as far as content. And whether or not this case is somehow, you know, the specialty portion of the license plate would or wouldn't be analogous to that kind of bulletin board on public property. And the other question had to do with state constitutions. Many of the state constitutions also have protections for speech. And your thoughts on whether this case would be relitigated at the state level in that regard.
Well, so as to bulletin boards, a lot depends on what kind of bulletin board this is. So for example, if you have, well, let's just take an example from my own government institution, UCLA Law School. In the very same building, there are many different kinds of bulletin boards. So there are some that are run by the school, in the sense that the school chooses what it is that's written up there. If that's so, then the school would, even under Justice Alito's opinion, be allowed to do that. If the administration wants a bulletin board with announcements about its programs, it doesn't have to allow announcements by other people. On the other hand, there are bulletin boards that are pretty clearly devoted to student groups. There's no indication on those that this is somehow the government that is speaking. It's pretty clear it's the Federalist Society or American Constitution Society or some other group that's speaking. That would be treated as a limited public forum, and I think the same would apply even after this decision. The harder question, you'd have to find something that is a little bit more in between. So here's an example that has been litigated some in lower courts. What about a city web page? A city web page is on the If you look at the URL, the address of the web page looks like it's coming from the city. It will often have the city's name on it, but may also, at least in some small towns, have lots of links to lots of civic groups. It may even allow civic groups to announce their events there, but within the context of a web page that comes across as being at cityofgilbert.az.us, let's say, and which has the City of Gilbert seal and title because it's all on one big page. Yes, I do think that this case would then strengthen the city's case for the proposition that, hey, this is our speech, even though we allow various groups to contribute to this speech. So I don't think that that's terribly likely the typical bulletin board issue, physical bulletin board issue, will be much affected. But these kinds of more mixed bulletin board issues, such as online pages, might be affected. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second question. Can you refresh my recollection?
Yeah, state constitutional independent rights.
Oh, yeah, state constitutions. Generally speaking, while every state constitution has a free speech protection of some sort, very few state courts have interpreted their state constitutions as providing broader protection for free speech. Occasionally they say it does. Very rarely do they actually come up with different rules. There are a couple of exceptions. One is when it comes, in fact, to public fora and even to private property that's been opened up to the public, some states, including my own California, do indeed provide some broader protection. And it's possible that in those states you could say, likewise, you should view the government speech doctrine, the federal government speech doctrine, as not applicable, at least in the same way, under the state constitution. Possible, not terribly likely, I think. Even in California, while the courts talk about this and occasionally rule in favor of greater speech protection, that hasn't happened much in recent years. The one other exception is Oregon. It turns out Oregon has come up with a very different framework under its own state constitution. I think it was an interesting attempt. I'm not sure it was ultimately that successful, but I could certainly see if this were an issue in Oregon, and off the top of my head, I don't know if Oregon has such a specialty plate program, I could certainly see it coming out a different way under this specialized Oregon state constitutional scheme. This having been said, if this is something that somebody on this call wants to litigate, it's certainly a worthwhile thing to raise, at least in those states that have not said, hey, we just apply our provisions exactly the same way as the federal constitution. So it's something that might be worth raising. I just don't think it's likely to go very far, judging by past track record of similar claims.
Well, Professor Volokh, as always, an informative 60 Minutes. I thank you for joining us and covering not one but two cases on the day they came out. I certainly appreciate it. To our audience, thank you for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at noon, when we'll be talking about securities markets and market regulation. But until that next Teleform call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.